Jazz.
Bastard.
Hey there, you ready?
Yeah, I think I'm ready.
Okie doke. If you hear crunching in the background, that's my mom eating a taco salad. So it's not my fault.
Okay.
Just a heads up on that.
All right. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 119. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And as always, we're brought to you by Sun Ra Pianos. Buy a Sun Ra piano, you'll never have to pay for a piano tuner again. Believe us, you won't. Sun Ra pianos, you know, our uprights aren't. Okay, sorry. I just had to get that done.
That's all right. These are, so Sunny is sort of the topic of the day since we're doing four Sunnies, but it's ironic you mentioned Sun Ra because his birth name was Herman, but he went by Sunny most of his life.
Yeah, jazz is rich in Sunnies. We're not doing Sonny Clark or Sonny Sherrock, but yeah, there's a lot out there. And of course, we talked
Sonny
about
Rollins
Sonny
or...
Rollins at great length a few episodes to get back. So yeah, it's that was in 114 when we talked about that amazing box set of performances with Don Cherry. So yeah, it's a popular name. I realized that there were four alto players whose first name was Sonny and suggested we do a show on those. So yeah, we're doing works by Sonny Stitt, Sonny Fortune, Sonny Chris, and Sonny Simmons. Kind of more historical, I guess, than we've been recently. And then I'm hopeful that after this, we can do an episode with some guests. So we'll see if we can work that out or not. Okay, I was thinking maybe start with the Sonnies who come out of the bebop tradition first and then move on to the more avant-garde ones. Does that sound okay?
Sure. So we're starting with Simmons.
Ha, ha, ha. Well, even
no.
he.
Well, to a degree, yeah. No,
when we get to him, yeah, there's some roots there. I was actually thinking of Sonny Stitt.
Sure.
Vertigo, right? That's one of the great movies of all time. I assume you've seen that a lot.
Oh, yeah. Many, many times.
You know, you're the cinephile here. You were like, you subscribed to something called Facets.
Yes.
And I checked, and they don't have all the Ernest movies. So, you know, if you don't have Ernest Goes to Camp, I just can't. I cannot put my money down. So I didn't sign up for them. But yeah, when I listen to Sonny Simmons, I think a little bit about Vertigo. It's like...
Sonny Simmons?
No, I'm sorry. Sonny Stitt. Who was the blonde in Vertigo? Was it Kim Novak?
It was Kim Novak.
And remember, like, Jimmy Stewart thinks she's dead, and then there's somebody who comes back that looks a lot like her, and he's like, is it her? Is it her twin? What's going on? And it's a little bit that way with me and Sonny Stitt and Charlie Parker, right? You listen to him, and it's like, is that Charlie? Is it sort of, wow, sounds a lot like Charlie, but I don't think it's Charlie.
There are some important distinctions, and to his credit, Sonny Stitt said he played like that before he ever heard Parker, and he said, I can't help it. This is how I sound. I didn't mean to sound like you. And wasn't Parker the one who noticed it first? Like, Parker's like, hey, we sound the same.
Right. I think that if you listen to the really early sides that Stitt does in the 40s, I'd say at that point, I don't think he's quite as confident. I don't know that his intonation is as good as it would become. I don't feel like he's as fully a formed a figure as Parker. But yeah, he's clearly playing in the same idiom, which we tend to think of as parented by Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell to some degree, you know, the kind of the forefathers of bebop. And Stitt is part of that group, and really he's recording very early on. He's laying down tracks in the mid-40s. I just, you know, I don't think they are as accomplished, and I don't, you know, as I listen to a lot of him, I decided I'm going to get some more Stitt. So there was this Mosaic set. They're the reissue company that makes big box sets alongside themes. And they had a Sonny Stitt box, 9 discs of all his Roost recordings. And by the time I thought of it, it was long out of print, but I was looking on Amazon. It's like, oh, you've got a complete set, but it doesn't have the box, doesn't have the booklet, which, of course, is what makes it more collectible. But that's fine with me. Okay, I'll get it, you know, $90. Well, it arrived, and several of the discs were missing. So I ended up kind of negotiating with the guy, and we kind of got the price down to 50. And after that, I thought, well, maybe it would haunt me with another artist. I'm missing these discs from the set. It's not complete.
Right.
But I got to say, with Sonny Stitt on Roost, you know, yeah, I'm probably okay with the number I got. You know, I don't know that I need every single one. There's a sort of amazing consistency of this guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't record a bad album, but I don't know that he's ever recorded like a 5-star album. He is just amazingly accomplished and locked in, and he is that way for 20, 30 years. He's got a long career.
He's dependable with vices that are a little less debilitating than Parker's. So when Parker couldn't perform, Gillespie hired Stitt to essentially, you know, be Charlie Parker in later iterations of Gillespie groups. So,
I did not know he'd work with Gillespie.
Yeah,
okay.
He did work with Gillespie in a kind of an all-star Gillespie band that naturally would have been a kind of a venue for Parker, except Parker was strung out and then dead. So that would be another big problem with employing him. You know, Sonny had his own. I got to be careful. Stitt. Let's go with last names. Stitt had his own demons, but they weren't apparently as debilitating. He was just heavy on the alcohol. He was a major alcoholic.
One of the big recordings I had of him was with Miles Davis in Scandinavia somewhere, where it was the last live recordings of the Coltrane, and then Stitt kind of took over. And I think I read somewhere recently that the reason he did not remain with Davis was the alcohol. Davis didn't find him reliable enough.
Yeah. I think that's the Stockholm. Miles in Stockholm. Yeah, I believe I have that 2-disc set, and you can't tell from the playing. At least I can't. You know, like, oh, that man's an alcoholic. And to be fair, there are some pretty high functioning alcoholics in jazz. Coleman Hawkins.
Right.
But apparently, Stitt's problems became a little more debilitating until finally, I guess he had to kind of go cold turkey at some point, way back.
Right. Yeah. He decides that he doesn't want to die too young, and does kind of get hold of it. And then makes it, I think, at least another few years or a decade before he does die of the jazz man's disease, you know, just kind of the abuse of the body taking him down. And it's really interesting if you're into Miles and know the idiom of that great quintet sextet he had with Coltrane, to then hear Stitt in it. Because Stitt is, of course, extreme. You know, it's not like he can't play on Green Dolphin Street, for fuck's sake. He absolutely can eat it for breakfast.
Right.
But he's still playing in an idiom that doesn't quite, it's like he's maybe 5 years earlier or something. It's just he's still in a really pretty clearly defined bebop, hard bop vocabulary.
Right, and Miles is already starting to stretch.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, Coltrane had been stretching like mad. I mean, his solos on those dates, I think I've got like 4 discs, but it's, some of it is Coltrane, and then Stitt takes over. And it's... it's a very much more probing and demanding idiom. And then Stitt comes in and he plays beautifully in a bebop style. So, he's got a long-standing career. He is a very prolifically recorded artist, and he was known as a solo. He would go from gig to gig and just pick up rhythm sections. He's not a guy that you think of as someone who sustained long-term, you know, for a matter of months or years, which is kind of long-term in jazz, a group. He was a guy that recorded with people, including lots of kind of encounters with people like Lockjaw Davis.
Right. Yeah, lots of tenor sax battles. So just to confirm what I said earlier, I was just checking. Yeah, he actually replaced Parker in Dizzy Gillespie's big band in the mid-40s.
Oh, okay.
So, which, you know, makes perfect sense. It's like, well, let's see. We want someone who can reliably play these licks, and, you know, we're not going to have to drag him out from underneath the bandstand, you know. Half stewed, he'll only be a quarter stewed. Okay, let's get Sonny.
There you go.
So,
and he can't. I want to stress, if you haven't heard him, he is masterful in that idiom. He is not. He doesn't sound like a pale Xerox of Parker.
Right.
I don't know what your take on him. Yeah.
There's some differences that we'll talk a little bit about.
Yeah.
There's some. Obviously, he's not Parker.
Right.
And there's a couple of places on this recording that we're about to talk about, that he's not Parker. Say a little bit about this before we talk about it. Say a little bit about this double. This is a CD that's two vinyl albums that have been put together on CD, and they're actually separate dates, 1960 and 1962. So say a little bit about them, because they have different personnel, and that even shows up in who gets to solo on the second album.
The reason I picked this was I was able to track down, I was looking for some Sonny Stitt on eMusic, because I just don't have a lot. He's just not somebody I've collected, and that's one reason I was kind of attracted to this Mosaic box. I thought, well, it's time I sit down and listen to a decent-sized swath of this guy's work. So as a kid, I had a cassette that had his tribute to Ellington on it, and I always liked that album quite a bit.
Let's be clear. This isn't he did two tributes to Ellington, a later one with strings.
Right, and this is not that.
This is not that. Okay.
And it may have had exactly the same title, because, again, he made a lot of fucking albums. And you don't think of Sonny as someone who is trying to carve out an oeuvre. You know, he's not thinking, you know, this will be my statement for eternity. It's somebody who recorded a lot. And not necessarily with a lot of planning or a lot of thematic coherence, just you get in the studio and blow. So
he was the John Zorn of his day, except he didn't form groups and compose
or have a lot of conceptual
label.
He was nothing like John Zorn. Other than he was prolific as fuck. And
not for a horn player. Like, you know, we talk about rhythm players being on hundreds and hundreds of albums, but for a horn player, like, he just turns up everywhere. He plays with everyone. He's all over the place.
Yeah, and I think, like Dexter, though, in some ways, I find Dexter a little bit more likable, a little bit more his person. I think they both have a personality. I just kind of like Dexter's better. But yeah,
he's affable a little bit, and it comes across in his playing a little bit more than Stitt's playing.
Right, exactly. But either one of them, you know, if you want to make a good, solid jazz record date, you call them, and they're going to show, I assume, unless they've got problems or doing business, and they're going to produce a absolutely solid, reliable performance almost every time. You know, they're going to be better than, you know, these guys are name players. They do have personalities. They have a talent level that's above the average Joe Blower. But at the same time, they aren't super persnickety about where they're going to play, and they're not going to agonize over the conception being brought across or the repertoire or anything else. They're gonna blow.
So let me build on that. Sure. For a second. There's a phrase, there's a new metric they use in baseball called WAR, wins above replacement value, which means if you take like your average third baseman, right? And then you compare your third baseman to the average third baseman, he will either be better or worse than the average third baseman, right? And then so they designate wins above replacement value and the number of games you win more if you have your guy as opposed to the average player at that position, right?
So, I see. Okay.
And Sonny Stitt would be like, he would have a pretty good WAR. He'd have a pretty good above replacement value. He's better than most alto players who you're going to get to play hard bop. He's at the top of the class. There's only a couple of guys up there with him. He's going to bring a lot to the table.
Yeah,
he's absolutely got a high wins above replacement value.
There you go. I like that, because there is something almost statistical when you think about the guy. So anyway, I found this Ellington album. I grown up with it. I always liked it. Really, you know, I listened to it before I heard anything else by Stitt, and probably before I'd heard more than a couple hundred jazz albums. And it came paired with Rearin' Back, which is just kind of another session he did. The very beginning of it starts, it's like the tape has been a bit abused, but then it's decent sound throughout. And it's just, it's more Stitt. So I just thought, well, let's pick something out. I know that I feel like he's pretty strong and at home on the Ellington date. And I guess that can, you know, my feeling was confirmed when I listened to it again. I think that it's a little bit above average Stitt. It just seems a little warmer and more relaxed, maybe. I don't know how to put it. I'm not somebody who has spent hours with him. When I ran into him in kind of a critical way was Brad Meldows. One of his notes talked about arguments you get into with people as a young musician, and one was, who's better, Sonny Stitt or Sonny Rollins? And his take was like, how could you even, this is not an argument, of course Sonny Rollins is better, but you know, he'd meet musicians who would say, no, in fact, Stitt is superior. And I'm sure it's entirely to do with the metrics you do, but it's kind of an interesting question. Now, Stitt, of course, plays alto, but also plays tenor. And for a while, he played a lot of tenor because he was tired of this debate about whether he was copying Parker. So since Parker really didn't play tenor, or almost never played it anyway, that was a little bit more of an identity for him. But he certainly then went back and kind of alternated between them. He's kind of an unusual exception where he was just equally fluent on either and equally comfortable playing either, whereas I've argued before that typically a saxophone player, you might have like a tenor doubling on soprano, but you don't often find a player that does both alto and tenor as kind of a main horn. It's kind of unusual. So, yeah, I just picked these out for that reason. Talk a little bit about the personnel and the differences you found there.
Oh, sure. So the personnel on the Rear and Back album is Ronnie Matthews on piano, Arthur Harper on bass, and Lex Humphries on drums. All capable players who turn up in other venues, other places. But none of them are what you would call front rank rhythm section guys. I mean, they're good. They're solid. There's nothing wrong.
Right.
I'm not dissing them. But the rhythm section on the Ellington tribute is significantly stronger. So Paul Chambers on bass, and I guess it's the Levies, Lou Levy on piano and Stan Levy on drums.
Okay.
But those guys are also good, but Paul Chambers is, of course, head and shoulders above all of those other names. And significantly, he gets room to solo. On the Ellington disc, that I think Harper gets one solo on the first disc, and Matthews might get one, but on the second disc, Levy on piano and Paul Chambers get significant room to solo, and maybe that just represents, you know, a concession to the fact that it's Paul Chambers, it's Paul freaking Chambers. So
okay, that may be another reason, along with just the repertoire, that not knowing any of that as a kid, I liked that session. Just had a little extra oomph to it. I don't know what your history with Sonny is. I remember looking him up when I was in a Bud Powell kick. Powell did some early bebop sides with Stitt on them. And so I was tracking those down just to hear the earliest Bud, because if you know Bud Powell's discography, things get rocky almost immediately after the late 40s because of the police brutality and mental illness.
Right.
And, you know, I wanted to hear him at absolute peak Budness. Yeah, I didn't collect a lot. Have you listened to it much before today?
Some, but usually with other people. So I've got the Dizzy Gillespie disc. Well, it's nominally Dizzy, called Sunny Side Up. That's Dizzy with Sonny Stitt and Sonny Rollins.
Oh, okay.
And I've got at least one of the Ammons Stitt workouts, Gene Ammons on tenor and Sonny Stitt. I have God Bless Jug and Sonny, and I think I have a couple others with them. For some reason, when I was on E-Music, they had damn near everything Gene Ammons recorded during a certain period. And you would get that stuff. So right. I think I have more than that with Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt. So I have those, and somewhere, but I haven't heard it in a long time, I have Tune Up, which is widely regarded as maybe his 4-star album out of a long career of 3.5-star albums.
Oh, you know? I don't think I've heard that one. Okay.
Yeah, it's but it's late in the game. It's, well, not late, but it's after he sort of comes back and slows down from 72.
Okay. So yeah, later in his, I don't have his dates in front of me. I should pull those up, but yeah, does he pass in the 70s?
I'll tell you. I actually do have the dates. Hang on a second. Let me just back up for 1 second here because I do have it. Hang on. So a lot of these guys are similar birth dates. They're all born near each other. He dies in 82. So he has a kind of last decade where after he's kind of more or less kicked the alcohol, he records and he slows down in his last decade. Instead of recording 20 dates a year, he records 10. But Tune Up is one of his last theater dates and is kind of widely regarded as maybe his best leader outing. That isn't to say it's his best outing. I'm going to guess that some of the stuff he played when he was younger, he often gets in, you know, he appears in a lot of these dual contexts, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm going to guess that he catches fire with guys a little more often in those settings. But I, like you, I'm not a completist, and I'd be interested to look at the stuff from the 70s just to have a better sense of him, because some of those things get really high ratings, and I don't know if that's just the fewness of the ratings that reflects that, but I'd be curious to find out.
Yeah, and he's born in 24, so 4 years younger than Charlie Parker.
Right.
And, you know, having listened to these again and then listened to some of the Mosaic material, and it opens with kind of a big band session, which has a little additional interest because of just the additional colors and moves involved with that. And it's pretty well-arranged stuff. But, yeah, I appreciate him, but I find that if I'm listening to one of those discs about an hour in, I'm ready to switch to something else. And I don't know whether a lot of time I was doing this at work or just with other things going on, but I don't know whether if I gave him, I think I've given him some kind of in the chair at home time where I'm just really focusing on it. And it's always very well done, and it's not like it's mechanical or something, but at the same time, there's kind of a hardness to his playing.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. It's notable that on this sort of dual album, the only ballad that I really think of as a ballad here is on the rear and back disc. That's the only ballad here, and that's Little Girl Blue, the Hart Rogers tune. And this is where I think you can separate Parker. This is one of the places where you can separate Parker and Stitt. Parker is just faster than Stitt, first of all, and Parker has a more fecund imagination than Stitt. But that's not by a lot. Stitt's damn fast, and he also has quite an imagination. But I think the way you can kind of separate them is Parker has a much bigger kind of musical vocabulary, much bigger musical appetite than Stitt does. And Parker feasted on ballads. Parker is a superlative player when he's playing ballads slow. He has just this featherlight touch that's really extraordinary, where he can sort of filigree and add the beautiful, well thought out little Rococo riffs that don't take away from the melody, but add to the melody. And Stitt can't do that. That's not his bag. That's not his forte. And the song that really shows that on this outing for me is Little Girl Blue. It's a perfectly competent ballad. There's nothing wrong with his playing here. But he just doesn't have that same featherlight touch that Parker does on a ballad, where just because Parker's playing soft doesn't mean that he is not fiendishly running scales. No, that's not quite right. He doesn't quite run scales. But it doesn't mean that he's not fiendishly elaborating on melody. Parker has this amazing ability to play fast and imaginatively and softly all at the same time. And I don't think Stitt can do that. It's just not his bag. Significantly here, the cuts on the Ellington and most of the cuts on the first half are all blues or bebop burners. And that's his speed. That's Stitt's wheelhouse. And he takes all the blues at a good clip. He can adapt his bebop skills, his hard bop skills to a blues idiom brilliantly. That's why the Ellington choices here are almost all blues. And he does a wonderful job with them. And he plays beautifully. Just don't ask him to play soft or slow. Those are the two things not going to do super well. It's not that he can't do it. It's just that he doesn't do it as brilliantly as he does the other stuff. You get the sense almost that, like, you know, there's a metronome in his head and he's like, faster, faster, faster. I mean, he's not the fastest player, but he's pretty damn fast. I think of Johnny Griffin as perhaps maybe the most ridiculously fast player, but he's a tenor. Yeah, everything seems, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of speed, Stitt's comfortable about 8, 8.5. He wants to dial it up, and he's real good there, and his riffs sound good there, and I like his riffs on this album. I don't feel like this is transcendent. And to be fair, I don't think that Paul Chambers' solos, which are awfully good, I don't think they're transcendent either. I think they're just really competent, really solid bass solos. But I don't think anything here is jaw-dropping. I just think it's good. Yeah. The only thing that's less than good is the attempt at a ballad. And wisely, he only does one. He or a producer said, you know what? Let's put the ballads away. And that was a good choice.
It's hard to imagine a producer on a Sonny's Tit Date.
That's true. I mean, what do you say to Sonny? Slow down. You know, what do you say to Sonny? It would be interesting to see if Sonny ever did. It would be interesting to see if Stitt ever did an album of ballads. What would that sound like?
Yeah, I'm sure that there are some attempts made. I don't know that I've heard any of them. Yeah, one of the comments I read glancingly somewhere was that he said when he played with pickup bands, he had to adjust so it would work, and they might only know a few hundred songs where he knew thousands of songs, so he'd have to pick songs that they know. So I kind of imagine him just walking into a studio, people calling out names, him playing them down, and just walking out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think with the Ellington Date, emotionally in some ways, he may be a little bit more comfortable fit with Ellington and the kind of swing musicians as opposed to the Beboppers, where there's that sense, at least with Parker, that there's kind of a, I don't know, angst-ridden modernist struggle going on, and you're bearing your soul in a way that you don't necessarily associate with players, say, in the 30s. And I don't know that Stitt ever gives me the impression of someone just struggling with the materials of his art and trying to find transcendence. And there's a kind of geniality to much of Ellington's, especially the stuff that Stitt plays, that it just kind of slots in. I just feel like it's just one degree more relaxed.
There is one exception.
Yeah. Okay.
Which would be Solitude. The introspective, the lyrics. I don't know if Ellington wrote the lyrics or someone wrote them for him, but Solitude is a fairly introspective, slow tempo song. And that's the least successful of Stitt's engagements here with Ellington. That's not to say it's unsuccessful. It's just the least convincing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Stitt in a introspective mood. Those are not two words that go together. Stitt and introspection. He's more of an extrovert.
Yeah, and he's someone who kind of found a thing and flew the colors of that thing for 30 years in his career. My sense has always been a Parker by the time he's recording for Verve. In the early 50s, is getting kind of bored of bebop. And I've heard rumors, at least, that he was, you know, maybe considering more advanced harmonic idioms or even thinking about free playing. I just would have, as I've said before, killed to know what he would have made of Ornette Coleman, say.
Yeah, the stars of Parker, that he was engaged with the most advanced classical music of his day. He was fascinated by, he wasn't fascinated by, you know, the romantics. He was fascinated by, like, Edgard Varese and Stravinsky. He's listening to the classical music equivalent of stuff that people, you know, how people would want to, like, beat Ornette Coleman up. That's what people wanted to do to Stravinsky or, you know, Schoenberg.
Oh, sure, right.
And that's the stuff he's listening to. So, yeah, one has the sense that Charlie would have gone a long way if he had stuck around.
And certainly this is not something we get from Stitt. You know, he is somebody who, again, finds his idiom and stays in his idiom and is hugely productive in it for many decades. So I enjoy it. I've enjoyed some of the stuff I found in Mosaic, and I'm fascinated by, but I don't know, thrilled by these weird recordings he made. They're not weird. They're just odd, I guess, with Miles Davis. But yeah, he remains somebody who I think is a great meat and potatoes player.
Yep.
And somebody who has got a really admirable level of craft. I mean, he is impressive.
Yes.
Very many players, including those with bigger names and reputations and more fetishized discographies, don't have his technical ability.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound like I'm damning him with faint praise. He's very good. He's at the front of the second rank or the back of the first rank, however you want to put it. If Charlie Parker didn't exist, we'd be talking about what a great player Sonny Stitt was all the time. One of the great giants on the alto. It's just that Charlie Parker did exist. So, and, you know, I'm interested, you know, he has this run in the late 60s, early 70s of soul albums, both on his own, but with others, you know. And I'd be interested to hear, is it just Stitt picking up soul and going, right, I can play what I play in this idiom too. It's not that he's suddenly a soul player. It's that I have the sense that he's probably just being Sonny Stitt and adapting his licks to this slightly different idiom. Like I said, that's why I think the blues, anything blues based is always going to be easy for him to kind of fit into. Cause he can just kind of slot his stylistics into that kind of idiom without a great deal of difficulty. But I could see why him trying to play with Miles starting any point in the 60s is going to be trouble.
Yeah. the other player who is out of, more directly out of the Parker mold.
Yes.
So I'm going to argue Sonny Criss, the person I realized his tone reminded me of and his approach, a kind of delicacy to his playing, especially in other recordings besides the one we're going to talk about, is Benny Carter. There's a little Benny Carter in him, I think. Sonny Criss, anyway, is another of these beboppers. Criss is, when is Criss born here? 27, so 3 years older, or younger rather than Sonny Stitt. So not a lot of difference there. For whatever reason, I guess because there's a period where he's releasing albums on Prestige that have some popular music in them in the 60s, and because he does this very modal date with arrangements by Horace Tapscott, that we're going to talk about, Sonny's Dream, I tend to think of him as a player in a sort of later idiom slightly than Stitt, even though they're more or less contemporaries.
And if there's someone who definitely had the influence issue, it's Criss, much more than Sonny Stitt. Stitt is essentially Parker's contemporary and arguably came to a sound similar to Parker's independently, although by the time that happened, Parker was really famous. But Criss is definitely a little younger, and he struggled his whole career with "You're Just a Charlie Parker Knockoff." And it's much more apparent on other, like you, I have a bunch of Criss. It's much more apparent on other albums than on this one, interestingly enough.
Though I think he sounds much more distinctive and different from Parker than Stitt does. There's something about his playing that just, again, with that fast type vibrato and just a kind of, as I said, I don't know whether you want to call it a delicacy, or the tone is not quite as rounded and rich. There's just a certain kind of elegance or slipperiness about the way he plays that I don't hear him and think Parker, even though I absolutely agree the idiom he's playing in is based there, right?
On other albums, he really does remind me a lot of Parker. This one, and this was a new one to me and a revelation, and it's far and away, I like all four albums we're talking about today, but this was a kind of surprise, and I think this is a great album. It doesn't remind me of Parker at all. This is an extraordinary piece of work.
Yeah, this is one that I read a great review of years ago, got years and years ago, and have not gotten much sense. I got this set of three albums on two CDs, I think from his Imperial Sessions, if I'm remembering the label correctly. And those are, I kind of liked them a little better this time listening to them, but certainly haven't gotten them, I guess, after getting Sonny's Dream, and then it's a series of 3 and 4 minute bebop-like performances of standards. They didn't have much interest for me. I did not further pursue his stuff. I've not heard a lot of the Prestige dates where he's, I think it's Prestige, it might be Contemporary, somebody under that banner that was sucked up by the Fantasy label, where he's doing, as I said, kind of popular tunes of the day and more of a 60s, six songs to an album kind of format. Haven't heard those, but yeah, Sonny's Dream, again, Tapscott doesn't play piano on it. Flanagan does,
right.
Interestingly.
And he composes all of the cuts. These are all Tapscott compositions.
And arrangements. And boys, and this is an amazing session. It's just really a can't miss.
You had me at tuba. You had me at
there
tuba.
There you go.
Ray Barber is here on tuba. It's a great, what is it, a non-ed, a tent-ed? It's a bunch of people. Conte Candoli on trumpet, Dick Nash on trombone. These are all names to conjure with, by the way. Dick Nash on trombone, Ray Draper on tuba, who's one of the two or three jazz tubaists. Is it tubists? Tubaists? I always wonder. David Schur on alto, although he has to simply be playing ensemble stuff because I don't.
Right.
There is a solo here on tenor, but that's Teddy Edwards. Pete Chrisleib on Barry, Tommy Flanagan on piano. He gets a few solos. Al McKibben on bass and Everett Brown Jr. on drums. So however many people that is.
My sense is it's a West Coast group.
Yep.
I think it's a West Coast label.
I think that's right. Yep.
And they call it like the New Birth of the Cool or something, but this is not really, it's about the size of the Birth of the Cool band, but it is not,
right.
it's miles away from like Dave Pell or somebody who's just living in that zone for a whole career.
Yeah.
It is much more kind of pulsing modal songs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little slight Middle Eastern tonalities. It's a more direct sound, completely successful on its own terms.
By no
means trying to imitate Gil Evans. It's Tapscott and probably one of the best known and most successful jazz recordings he was ever associated with, because he was recorded so little as a leader And yeah, this one is kind of, he is the power behind the throne, and he frames Chris beautifully, who responds beautifully on soprano and alto, and just comes up with a magnificent set of music.
Yeah, I love this album. I wanted to ask you, the first two songs, Sonny's Dream and Ballad for Samuel, are those in 3/4 time? What is that time, that waltz time, or is it 6/8 or something? It's not 4/4. What is the time signature? Do you know?
I think you're right. I think it's a waltz. I don't think it's like a compound meter. I'm trying to bring it back to my head. Yeah, and it's a 3 feel anyway. I'm not sure how they wrote it out, but.
Both the first two songs have that feel, and as soon as it came on, I was like, my ears perked up instantly, right? Because I'm expecting a Parker disciple, and that happens, and I'm like, where are we? So first of all, the time signature. Second of all, the instrumentation is very bottom heavy. It's very bottom heavy. The trumpet gets some work out here. Conti Candoli gets at least one solo, but it's very bottom heavy with the trombone and the tuba and the berry and the bass and even the tenor. I mean, Teddy Edwards he gets one solo as far as I can tell, right? So this is a bottom heavy ensemble, and it's basically Tapscott setting up this kind of lush, round, plummy sound against which Chris can solo. And it's just a brilliant fucking choice. It just makes all the sense in the world. And I think the compositions are fantastic. And the one that I was going to question turns out to be the one he plays soprano on. So when you first hear Daughter of Cochise, we sometimes talk about white musicians or white culture appropriating African-American culture, right? And you hear the beginning of Daughter of Cochise, and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, this is going to be some tacky as shit appropriation of what someone thinks of as native tribal rhythms or something. And then Sonny comes in on soprano, and oh my God, I love him on soprano. I would get an album of him playing soprano, and here's why. I think he's an incredibly fleet, incredibly inventive alto player. And on this album, he's especially got a kind of wailing, almost plaintive tone throughout the way he reacts against this ensemble. But on Daughter of Cochise, when he's playing soprano, he has to play a little slower, and he's a little more thoughtful. And the gain in richness of conception and the sacrifice of perhaps a little bit of fleetness of finger, I'll take that trade every time. He is in very fine form on that song. It's a long song, the longest on the album. I thought it was the highlight, but I liked, there isn't a bad cut here. There's not a song here that I don't like. The closest and the least inventive thing here, the closest to bebop is something called Sandy and Niles. But everything else is kind of quirky. You're right, it's close to modal, and with this orchestration, it's just a lavish, lavish setting for Chris to play off against. And I think he does a wonderful job here, and he doesn't sound like Parker. I don't think the Parkerisms that people sometimes, that I sometimes hear in his playing, are present here. And I think it has everything to do with this weird, somewhat quirky instrumentation and quirky arrangement, which is a tip to anyone who sounds the same. Find you a whack, somewhat underappreciated composer and let him arrange your next album with weird instrumentation.
Yeah, it helps if he's good, right? You want to get a good
one. It helps if he's Taurus Tapscott. Yeah, that's a big plus.
Yeah, apparently this was on Prestige, and it's well recorded. It's a good sounding album and very clear and just a good studio work, and that makes a difference. Yeah, especially with a larger group like this.
I'm glad you mentioned that. It sounds magnificent. It's beautifully recorded.
Because a lot, like, again, with Sonny Stitt, he's going to be in studios of varying quality, but some of them are kind of indifferent. They're not necessarily incompetent or bad sounding. It's not like he's, on the Sun Ra special or something, but they're not always as lush. And this is the one where if it had been recorded in a second-rate studio or by a second-rate engineer, it just wouldn't be as valuable a document. But because they really capture what's going on, it's really engaging. So yeah, very highly recommended. And for many listeners, it may be this is the only Sonny Chris album you necessarily need. I do feel he's different. He's a little bit more. I just think he's of him as more of an air sign. Not that he's anything like Dolphy in conception, but there's just kind of a his tone is a little bit more in the mouthpiece. I think his alto playing, I would say that just seems like it's higher in conception and pitch, maybe just slightly sharp, but just also that just somebody who is, I guess, living more on the upper octave of the horn. I'm not sure that that's actually true or whether it's just an impression I get of him. But yeah, that's kind of the character I've got. And again, in a straight ahead setting, if he's doing like 4 minute of Bach performance, I don't find him all that compelling. He's certainly accomplished and fine, but not somebody who necessarily speaks to me, but in this setting, yeah, it's great. And yeah, Sonny's Dream is definitely worth looking up, and it's exactly the kind of album you might miss if you're not deeply into jazz, because it's just not a name that for most of us has a lot of resonance anymore. You just don't hear much about Sonny Criss. Stitt, at least, if nothing else, is prolific enough that most jazz bows have heard of him. They just made so much damn product. But Criss did not have that kind of career, and he's often forgotten.
Talk about his sad, sad demise. Briefly.
You know, why don't you talk about a sad, sad demise?
I thought you knew about it. He had stomach cancer and shot himself.
Yes,
he killed himself
because of
the pain of his cancer.
Yes, yeah. Thank you for bringing that back. I remember reading about it, probably just blocked it because what a way to go.
Yeah, Jesus.
Well, you know, at some level.
He was only 50, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But I can imagine, if you can't treat it and it's just agony and Dr. Kevorkian is not available. Yeah, I'm not sure I would have shot myself, but I'm probably too wimpy for that. But yeah, you start looking for an exit strategy with some kind of dignity to get out of that load. Yeah, sad ending for the guy. And I keep thinking at some point I should listen to those 60s albums, at least one or two of them, just to find out what was he up to apart from this Tapscott project, but a little bit later into his career when he's stretching out a little bit more. I'm assuming, like a Charles McPherson, looking to some more recent music and trying to add that to the idiom and just, working with maybe a little bit more advanced set of players than he was on those early Imperial sides. Haven't heard him yet, but maybe one of these days. So moving on, we're going to talk about a player who is more transitionally part of, more advanced idioms. Sonny Fortune, I think many of us would have encountered him as a sideman to Miles Davis in one of Miles' thorniest periods, the 70s. And then he goes on to kind of a sporadic career after that. And I picked out a weird album that I got as an LP dub on the internet, because some of his Fortune stuff has been out of print. We talked about maybe doing 4-in-1, which is a Blue Note date he did of Monk Tunes, and which, going back to that, I realized, this is probably easily the strongest thing I've heard him do. It's a very, very fine recording. If you run into it, I strongly recommend it. Serengeti Minstrel is a little more 70s in conception, but I kind of like it. Good personnel.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah. Who's the personnel? I know there's a lot of percussion here, but who are the main name players here?
Well, I think our buddy Jack DeJohnette is on percussion.
Yeah.
And Gary King on bass, but you have heard of Kenny Barron on electric piano.
That's right.
So very strong there, and then a congo bongo player. So
bongo, and there's some triangle here. There's some fine triangle work.
Yeah, it opens with a track that I had not had as part of the rest of the album because it somehow its metadata got stripped. It was kind of floating around in the dark alleys of my server, and I had to track it down. But yeah, amazing recording in terms of it's on Atlantic from 1977. But the percussion, the stereo separation, is just kind of like a bath you can sink into. There's little things bipping and bopping in both ears. High production value. It's got a certain 70s slickness to it, but I think it works well. And on some of the tracks, Woody Shaw appears.
Yes.
So, someday we're going to do a show on Woody.
Yes.
Very, very fun.
We should do an all Woody show.
I think I'd give Woody Shaw his own his own show, but yes, we could. What is
what other Woodies are there? There must be at least one other Woody out there.
Well, who's
Woody Herman?
Yes, I was going to say a great trumpet player and a lousy clarinetist. You know, we could completely different in any way. Yeah,
yeah.
There may be some other Woodies out there too. Yeah, so this is a one of those albums from the 70s. Bobby Hutcherson has several on Columbia where there is certainly some slickness of production and some electricity, but at the same time, the jazz content is very high and very real. And I think it works beautifully. I don't think there's anything wrong with the occasional 70s jazz album. I don't think that's bad. If it's well done, good personnel, serious soloing, and it's not just too pandering. I mean, this one's got no vocals, nothing to complain about. It's pretty good. So what do you think of this one? I assume you had not listened to it before. I really had not borne down on it till now.
No, I've never heard it before, and I think this may be the only Sonny Fortune disc I have. So the title's a little misleading because it's called Serengeti Minstrel, so you naturally assume that we're going to get, I don't know, African polyrhythms, or, you know, the Serengeti Desert is in Africa. But it should have been called, like, Havana Minstrel, because this is Afro-Cuban fusion. It's not Bob, it's like Afro-Cuban fusion or something. He overblows a little bit, which I kind of like in this setting. I don't mind very much. I do think that this setting is a little less congenial for Woody Shaw than it is for Sonny Fortune. Fortune seems very happy here. He's like a hog and shit. He's really, this is his idiom. Like, I think this just seems like a very congenial setting for his playing. And Woody Shaw is a little bit more, I've listened to a lot of Woody Shaw now at this point. And I feel like he's a little more contemplative or thoughtful player. He's not the kind of guy who unbuttons his shirt down to his navel. This didn't feel like a good bag for him. His solos are fine, but he doesn't seem, I don't think his solos quite catch fire the way that Sonny Fortune solos do. Fortune seems totally at home with this sort of fusion realm, and the overblowing that he engages in it sometimes just seems right. He just sounds good here. And I'm not as convinced that Woody Shaw was having a good time,
yeah.
Which isn't to say that his playing isn't very good. I just don't find him as compelling. And I think he's a great player, but I didn't think his soloing here was as... He sounds like... Sonny Fortune's like, to go back to the metaphor I used earlier with Sonny said, Sonny Fortune is like playing at 8, 8.5 on everything. And Woody Shaw's 6. He's like, he's just a little slower, a little more thoughtful, a little less extroverted. And I think Sonny Fortune is an extrovert just on my one encounter with him here and the way in which he kind of relishes this setting. I hate the bass, the way it's recorded, as you already know. You could predict that. And I'm not particularly happy with Kenny Barron's piano here. I know that, like, it's a law for this type of recording that it has to be electric piano, but gosh, I'm not sure. I would have been happy if it had been acoustic. I guess for this recording, it had to be electric, but
probably Woody would have been too. Yeah, he's
not
a guy that liked electricity in his music, and not somebody to think of as playing over a bed of percussion. He's more of a small group. Now, he does do some beautifully, richly orchestrated music on Columbia. So it's not that he's opposed to something that's catchy or mellow. But yeah, these aren't necessarily the context that he'd ever place himself in as a leader.
I can imagine Jaco Pastorius showing up shirtless, bell-bottom pants here, and Woody sort of going,
there you okay. go. You know? Sonny giving him a high five and bringing him right into the fold. Yeah, that
right.
That would have been awesome. Like, yeah.
Woody's like, should I unbutton this one more? Wait, what? And maybe Woody Shaw is just down with fusion and he loves it, but he just doesn't sound as happy here as Sonny Fortune does.
No, he wasn't. He was on record as not being down with fusion. So,
oh, really?
No,
oh, really?
He made that
okay.
clear. He was, and if you listen to his ample solo work, again, it's not that he is opposed to music that has a certain 70s sound to it, to me, in terms of the orchestration. I mean, I love it, but it's not all hard-edged. He's a very good composer, as we've said before. But yeah, he's not somebody who liked electricity. He resisted it his whole career. A bitter pill, of course, when, like so many other artists, he was overshadowed by Wynton Marsalis, when arguably he had a more original approach to the trumpet. He was known for kind of playing in fourths and kind of incorporating some of Coltrane's idiom and being, you know, true to acoustic jazz, but not the right age, not the right degree of, he wasn't photogenic enough, etc. So, yeah, no, he was somebody who didn't like it. I mean, there were certainly some people in the 70s who just did not like electrification or the CTI sound and just kind of stayed away from it. He was one of those. Where you'll hear Sonny Fortune with Miles are on a couple massive double albums released.
Right.
The very end, before he retreats to his Cocaine Paranoia haze for several years, recorded in Japan and originally released only in Japan, Pangea and Agartha, which is probably the stronger of the two. And those are both double albums. I don't know that, I think Sonny is fine on those, Fortune, but I don't know that listening to them, I think a new saxophone genius has been discovered. He works well in that idiom, but I don't know that he's what my ears are drawn to or the most memorable thing about those. But of course, having played with Miles, you've kind of got a lifetime calling card after doing that. And 4-in-1, which is probably out of print, or maybe there's a European reissue there. He just seems happy to be playing Monk. Apparently, he was not somebody deeply versed in Monk's music before doing it. And there's just something, an extra something in his playing, a kind of joy of discovery. That is, he's a little bit sour sounding sometimes. He's loose, you know, he's bringing just a little bit of the avant-garde to it. And there's excellent piano on that album, and I really recommend it. It's much more of a traditional small jazz group.
Yeah, I have that. And yeah, he mixes up his, he's got two bass players and two drummers on that. But yeah, the piano player is Kirk Lightsey. I don't know if you know or like his stuff, but yeah, I've had that disc for a while and I do like it. And that was my only other Sonny Fortune disc.
Right.
I had to check while you were talking, but I realized I do have it.
Like, I do have that. And it's, I was not particularly ready for a one. I just had listened to it so much because it was an album I had pretty early on and listened to a lot and then never really found the follow up. Like, where's more Sonny? There just wasn't a lot around. I think he did some more albums with Blue Note that sunk without a trace. And he's just not been somebody who's recorded a lot as a leader over the years. I saw him several years ago at the Jazz Kitchen live, and it was an okay performance. But he soloed at great length on every number, and it just seemed a bit blustery finally. The chemistry was not happening that particular night. It was neat to see him, of course, because in a sense, you know, here's this guy that kind of got a legendary career, a play with Miles, the height of kind of the Dark Prince stage, when Pete Cozy was just freaking out on guitar and all the rest of it, and then made this album that to me was kind of an important mainstream jazz album of its time, the Monk album. But yeah, the particular live show I saw on him wasn't great. And yeah, he's somebody who plays flute, plays soprano, plays alto. Not nature's greatest flautist, but he's fine. You know, he's a colorist on flute, but he's not a monster the way a Luke Tabakin would be or a James Newton. You know, he's not that good on the instrument, but he's good enough to play it. He's a little stronger on this album than he was back with Miles. You know, there it's a little callow sounding, frankly. But yeah, it's just a player you don't hear much about. And I like this album a lot, but the electric bass sound, the electric piano sound, this does not bother me the way it bothers you. I find it, if it's well done, kind of comforting, I guess, because it reminds me of my youth, I guess. The mellow 70s. Let's turn on Three's Company and play some Sonny Fortune. And I think it is. It's a good commercial jazz album, not a commercial album with jazz trimmings, but in a way that, you know, a couple of the Bobby Hutchersons I've been talking about, you know, are that, you know, they're trying to make it sound acceptable to 70s ears, but
yeah,
it's still got real music, real musicians. So yeah, I recommend it. It may be kind of difficult to track this one down. I think you might be able to get it as an import. Again, not a guy that has had a lot of profile. And on the strength of this, I think that as I like this album as together, I like him a lot on the Monk album. I don't think I've ever been convinced that he is a, you know, massive, miraculous talent on the saxophone. He's really good. Very different from like a Sonny Stitt. But I think if you think of somebody who makes his bones in the late 60s, 70s, I'd say about that level, just not nearly as prolific. But, you know, somebody who is a very good craftsperson, fair amount of talent, good soloist, but not one of the great conceptualists or an instrumentalist who just kind of awes you. You know, he's not just a jaw dropper to somebody. I can't believe you played that kind of guy.
So, right.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought it was, I just wanted to do something different. And I'm glad we did because it let me spend some time. You know, the only other album I've got by him is Long Before Our Mothers Cried. And that was a dub of a harshly treated LP. So it's very noisy, whoever had that one. And it's also just a little bit more hectoring, less inspired. It's kind of in the same idiom, but I don't think nearly as strong. So if you get a choice between the two, I'd say go with Serengeti Minstrel every time. But if you run across 4-in-1, do pick that up. I think you'll enjoy it. It is a good recording of Monk Tunes, and it's somebody who is excited to be playing Monk Tunes and really having fun doing it, where sometimes it sounds more like a, you know, kind of, I got to check this box, or the producer made me do it. He's having fun. Our final Sonny is by far the furthest Sonny out.
Yes.
He is our most avant-garde of stars. And we haven't been doing so. What are the other birth dates? If Chris is 27 and Stitt is 24, Fortune is, when is Sonny
39.
Okay, so he's 39. A little different generation. How about Simmons?
33. And still alive, still playing.
As is, I believe, Sonny Fortune.
Right.
Yeah, Simmons, wow.
Got an amazing life story.
Yeah, and some of his early stuff, you know, you're mentioning some connections to Parker and certainly Ornette. I've for many years had, he did an album with Prince Lasha, or Lasha, I'm not sure how you say it. And that's a good one.
Yes.
And there's
they record a lot of albums together at the beginning of Simmons' career.
Yeah, I used to, for some reason, I thought I had The Cry, but I don't seem to have The Cry, but I have Firebirds, which is a lot of fun because Bobby Hutcherson's on it, among other people. And Lasha's another multi-instrumentalist. He plays flute, plays alto, plays tenor. So it's kind of a two-reed front line. And that's more accessible. You know, as I listen to Simmons, I guess sometimes I think about a continuum from Ornette to Coltrane to Albert Eiler. And when I listen to Simmons, I think it's more like an equilateral triangle for some reason. He's somebody that is drawing on all those influences seemingly equally. Maybe the least Coltrane, and that he's not much of a pattern runner.
Right.
You know, he's not a scalar player particularly. But he's certainly got some of Ornette's tunefulness, but he's also got the power and the cry and the, you know, kind of outer space tendencies of an Albert Eiler. So you recommended we try Burning Spirits. Was it an album in your playlist or just something that you ran across as being recommended?
Pat, you ignorant slut. No, I never recommended it. The only Simmons I had before this was Ancient Rituals. So your memory failed.
Well, you must have told me. Maybe I gave you choices.
I think you
said,
yeah, and I looked up what got good ratings, and this on Rate Your Music is his highest rated album by a stretch, I think.
There we go. Okay, now it's all coming back to me, as if from a dream.
Yeah, so on albums, yes. So Rate Your Music, an interesting resource that I sometimes spend time on. Rate Your Music, if you get anything above 3.75, it's a 5-point scale. If you get anything above 3.75, that's really good. And when this and Firebirds are the two albums, well, that's not quite true. Firebirds has the most ratings, and it's his second highest rated album. It's got the most reviews. The second most ratings is his first album with Prince Lasha called The Cry. But yeah, Burning Spirits is his highest rated album with, you know, a significant number of ratings. I think that's why I picked it, just because I wanted to know if Rate Your Music, you know, was right.
So there are three things that jump out about this album to me. The first is his then wife or partner, paramour, I think she was his wife, Barbara Donald, plays trumpet here. And there aren't, I'm going to be careful how I put this. There used to be fewer female horn players than there are now. I would imagine there are many, many more horn players, brass and reeds, than there used to be. But she's good.
Yeah. Did you say that? She's fan-fucking-tastic. And I would like to know if she recorded any solo albums. I didn't even bother to look. But she's fantastic. And I didn't realize, I mean, I just, when I was listening to this, before I did any reading about it, I was like, who the fuck is that trumpet player? He's really good. And then I look it up, I'm like, holy shit, it's his wife. She's really good. She doesn't appear on every track. She appears, I think, on 4. But my God, a lot of power. She's a powerful player. A lot of power. She does get into a fair number of runs on the trumpet. She's more scalar, I think, than he is, to use your word. So she was a revelation, a pleasant revelation. I thought she was fantastic. On Healing Rays, all the songs here are about 10 plus. I think the shortest is 9, but all the songs are, you know, 11 to 15 minutes. On Healing Rays, the third cut, we have about, how many minutes would you say is it? 3, 4, 5 minutes of bass solo. Fortunately, before everyone hangs up, that's Richard Davis. So, okay. Okay. Then okay. If it's Dick Davis, it's okay. I actually kind of like the bass solo, but it does go on a really long time. And it's a big change of pace in the middle of what is a lot of thorny, rebarbative playing. And then I think it's the fifth cut. Sonny Simmons breaks out the English horn. My God, I love that. We need more English horn and oboe and jazz. I think that's really cool. I really like that song. I think it's Things and Beings. Really sinuous, plummy tone. Anytime I hear something that I almost always think Dolphy, and I know that that's just stupid, but I can't help it. I mean, because the English horn doesn't sound anything like a bass clarinet. But when you hear that sort of reedy, woody, angular sound, the part of my brain that thinks Eric Dolphy lights up. And so on that song, I was like, Dolphy, Dolphy. But I know it's not a bass clarinet, fans. Don't yell at me. It's an English horn, and they sound different. But I loved that song. It had a kind of, I don't know how, what you want to call it, kind of a Middle Eastern or, you know,
right,
kind
yes,
of
very
North
much,
African yeah. feel. I just thought that was fantastic. I really liked that. As an out player, he's fine. I enjoyed him. He swaps between alto and tenor here. I think actually on the first song, I think he plays both on one song. But he's mostly on alto here. And he's not Jackie McLean screechy, but there's some overblowing. And he's not, what is Jackie? Sharp? Flat Jackie Sharp. He's not sharp like Jackie. But yeah, this is an out album, and I really liked it. I didn't like it as much as the Tapscott Chris album, but it's a shade less than that for me, but it's damn close. I like this quite a bit. I hope you liked it.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What do you think of it?
And okay. It was originally a double LP, so it is a lengthy, you know, this is from, let's see, 19, I want to say 70-something.
I think, yeah, I think it's 1970, and released in 71. Yeah.
On the contemporary jazz label, which both did kind of West Coast mainstream jazz, but also released a couple of Ornette Coleman's early records, and it's beautifully recorded.
Sounds and, wonderful.
Oh, it does. And the great thing about the bass solo is that it's not just Richard Davis, it's Cecil McBee. And so a lot of
they're both playing on that.
And
I didn't realize.
You get one per ear. Unlike there's an Andrew Hill.
I'm not listening on big boy headphones. I'll have to put this on when I get home. Holy
yeah.
shit.
No, so much.
I did not realize that.
You know, I've talked about Andrew Hill's album Smokestack, which has two bass players, and they just evilly put them both in the center channel, so you cannot tell what the fuck's going on. But these are just delightful because you've got one in each ear, and there's very complex playing going on, but you can follow it because you know it's very clear exactly who's playing what, and they're beautifully captured. As I said before, the most important music in terms of recording quality is actually avant-garde, because you need to hear everything that's going on at all times as clearly as humanly possible to enjoy it to the maximum.
Because you can't anticipate, the way, like with bebop, or swing, like you know where things are going. With avant-garde, anything can happen.
And there's rarely that sense of there might be a period where the rhythm section is performing important work, but kind of a backdrop. Not so much in the avant-garde. Typically, they're taking the initiative all the time, as well as the horn players. And so, to understand what they're going to do, you need to hear them. You can hear everything beautifully on this record. It is a delight. It is definitely headphone friendly and almost headphone required.
Yeah, I would
say. Once you get it, boy, it's like you've got two brilliant bass players, one on either side of you. You can hear the wood in their basses, and they're playing really delightful stuff that maybe the nature of the instrument and maybe just their conceptions is probably a little bit more accessible at times than the horn playing. The violin playing, maybe not my favorite bit of this. It is better than Ornette Coleman's violin playing.
Was there a violin here? I didn't hear a violin. Was there a violin?
Yep. Yeah, there's
the violin. I'm making a joke. I didn't pay any attention to the violin.
Yeah, you're kind of right. I mean, it's not terrible, but you do tend to tune them out. Those are not the high points. But I would absolutely agree. Barbara Donald is no Linda McCartney, right?
She's a fucking monster. I'm going to look up right now how many albums she has, because holy shit, she is good.
Yeah, absolutely. Very fine.
She would have been great on that date with Simmons. She would have been very... Wait, Simmons, Chris, Stitt. Fortune. She would have been great on the Fortune date. mixing up my Sunnies.
Would have been a different album.
She has one disc from 1983.
Yeah,
I could find.
This is... Wow. Yeah, these guys are... And apparently for a while, Sonny Simmons was homeless. He, after this recording, apparently kind of dropped out for a while.
From the Charles Gayle School, was like busking up streets and stuff. Ugh,
and as we've said many times, the children of Eiler, and Eiler himself, of course, had a very rough time of it. It was not a career path that led to flowers and riches, let's face it. Very hard going, and lots of misunderstanding and hatred directed towards that music. And I'm perfectly sympathetic to someone who puts this on and says, this is too much for me. I don't like this. This is not music that speaks to me or does anything that I want music to do for me. I do think it is a lot for me. It is very rewarding and enjoyable music in this idiom. I don't find it particularly off-putting. I don't think it is. It's not Brotsman's nipples or something. It's not Albert Eiler at his most hectoring. It's certainly more accessible than that. That said, if you feel like you're coming at this from the right and you want to inch your way onto the ledge, start with Firebirds maybe. And that's probably spicy enough that if you have trouble with it, you don't want to go further. This is a little bit further than Firebirds yet, but I think it's good stuff. I think the playing is not just navel-gazing or self-indulgence. It's certainly not by incompetent musicians. There's some fantastic musicians on this date. Not the violin player, but otherwise, very good.
And the trumpet playing, Barbara Donald's trumpet, she is fiery player. I mean,
she's good. She may be better than Simmons.
She attracted my ears more often than he did, except when he went to the English horn, and then I was, mesmerized.
I'm not sure if he attracted my ears on the English horn, but there the intonation is now a sort of a second cousin to what's going on, but it is cool. It's a neat...
Well,
he'll do
you
that
try and play English horn,
exactly. It's a weird... Well, and that, that is a characteristic mode for so many avant-garde musicians, and of course, the great exemplar being Ornette Coleman with trumpet, with violin, that what you're trying to do is not necessarily related to mastery of an instrument.
Right.
And so a willingness to kind of branch out with playing that, let's face it, they're not going to sign Sonny up for the Philharmonic any day soon, right? He'd be shot in the back alley immediately. But he's like, this is another way I can express myself, and it's very distinctive, and it takes me to different places in my playing than the alto or the tenor. And it's a legitimate way. I don't have to be perfect on it to make a statement. And I do think it works on those grounds. But if you come to it expecting a symphony level performance from him or mastery of the horn, you're not going to leave happy. So I think this is just a great album. I think it's well paced. The tunes are lengthy, but I don't think they are super self-indulgent or
no.
Treading water. I think that they earned their length.
That's one of the advantages of out jazz is that, you know, you don't think, God, not another chorus, you know, because it's like, what chorus?
There are choruses, right. Well, there's enough, you know, there's enough different players here. And I'm, you know, to be honest, those bass solos with those two guys going at it, I like those. I mean, they're a great change in temperature and texture. And I think the playing is worthy of listening. I mean, I like it better than many mainstream jazz solos. And I just think they found a place harmonically and rhythmically that they really are kind of firing at maximum. I think that what they produce is some of the best playing I've heard from either man. It's challenging, but it's rewarding. I like it a lot. So that's just a lot of fun. And again, the fact that this is very well recorded, and so you can hear it and you get pleasure from the tone of the instruments, it's just a super bonus. So highly recommended. But yeah, I like, you know, I listened to Staying on the Watch ESP, and even that didn't seem quite as rough as some of their documents. I felt like it was more accessible than some of the albums I've heard on that label, which can be very right. challenging.
Well, that's a lot of that is Sun Ra's fault. I don't think ESP is to blame for some of the shit that Sun Ra records. But.
No, but I mean, they've done a number of often, you know, debut albums or first and second albums by avant-garde figures who then move to at least bigger operations.
Places with real soundboards and real engineers.
There you go. Tape instead of, you know, paper or whatever. You know, that one's fun. For years, I've had this recording. For whatever reason, I've got a lot more Sonny Simmons than I do Sonny Fortune, called Backwoods Suite. And that was just kind of floating around in a bin somewhere. Billy Higgins is on drums on that one, and it's a likable session. So, and also recording I've got with Horace Tapscott that I've not listened to recently. I think they were both maybe past their prime at that point. So.
Well, you have him on two Dolphy dates that you may not realize. He's on Iron Man. And
okay,
he's
that's
also,
right. Yeah,
he's
yeah.
also on the Milestones disc. I think it's Milestone Conversations, both from 1963. So that's made me want to, when I get back home, dig those discs out and hear what he does with someone who I think is an obvious kind of model for him, especially with the odd horn choices, you know?
Yeah, my sense has always been, I think of him, if we had to choose, more out of the Ornette tributary than Coltrane. And the lesson of the 70s seemed to be, if you take Coltrane to a point, and that point being still recognizably tonal music, and emulate him, you can do okay. But if you try to be in the school of Ornette, you tend to get peed on by the general public and ignored. Whether it's Bobby Bradford with John Carter, those groups made some, I think, really fine music and music that I enjoy as much or more than many of the School of Coltrane discs that came out in the 70s. But boy, obscurity seems to have been there a lot. And I feel like with Simmons, you know, as somebody who draws on Eiler and draws on Coleman Hawkins, let me try it again, Ornette Coleman, yeah, he chose a path that was not rewarded in the marketplace or the mind share of 70s jazz. He stayed pretty obscure. And I think his playing is enjoyable. I think his recordings really are, to me, more accessible and more pleasurable avant-garde offerings than many of the stuff that took Eiler out to outer space or kind of obsessed about late period Coltrane. So I recommend
I'm going to go out on a limb and say he's closer in sensibility to Dolphy, who is, you know, the paradigmatic,
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
The paradigmatic inside-outside guy who could... Dolphy certainly pushed Coltrane in places Coltrane had... You stretch Coltrane enormously. And Dolphy, I always thought, was the more adventurous player in some ways. So, yeah, Dolphy seems more like the model here for me.
Yeah,
right down
not.
To the lack of commercial success.
Right.
If Dolphy had lived, he would have been a poor man.
I wouldn't say that he's not as a player in the sense of, I think in his conception of career and what he's trying to accomplish, absolutely. I don't know that his soloing, he doesn't have the intervallic obsession, and he doesn't quite have the gift of, you know, speaking to the birds, as it were. He's not as much of the air as Dolphy is, but... Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, that's a figure that's probably worth bringing up more often if you're trying to figure out where you place people on these continuums, because Dolphy never gives up tonality exactly. He just taffies it quite a bit, pulls it all directions.
He's very comfortable doing so. You get the sense that he's like a stress-free guy. You know, he's like,
right.
Let's do this. And Coltrane's like, wait, let me think about it. You know?
Yeah, oh yeah. yeah, and he is someone who will take a relatively mainstream idiom and just... briefly go to outer space in it. He's not, he's kind of willing to to take off in more traditional contexts, with a great example being that there's a song on Mingus, 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 Mingus that used to be on the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, where the Dolphy solo is just, and I mean, it, you hear it once and it never leaves your mind. And it's just like, what the hell was that? I mean, it's out for even by Mingus' standards, and just absolutely successful and indelible. So, yeah, Simmons is not, I guess ultimately, it's, I don't know that Sonny Simmons is the most spectacularly gifted player in the
right.
stadium. I think he's good, but I don't know, again, that he is just somebody who, he's like somebody who finds this and says, yeah, this is a language that makes sense to me, and pursues it, and tries to carve his own niche in it. It's just, unfortunately, that was the least... pragmatic decision you can make at this time in history, and it,
yeah.
as you said, it was extremely rough on him personally as well as financially. So look it up. Yeah, I think if you like the avant-garde at all, this is a really good candidate for your streaming service or your shelf or wherever you keep your music. It's going to reward you. I think all these recordings are pleasurable.
They're all good, but this and the Tapscott Chris. Sonny's Dream. These two are my favorites by far. The other two are fine. They're good. They're like 3.5-star recordings, but these are 4-star recordings, I think. They're really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd agree. And they're both, I think, really good examples of that particular player.
Yeah.
If you wanted to pull a couple items for your memories of or your monument to these players, those are the ones you want to include, those for sure. So yeah, a bunch of Sonnies here, people that you're not going to think about necessarily a lot. I think all talented musicians, none of them are kind of colossi, saxophone colossi or other, but
colossi.
they're not the kind of monument that Nuke is going to be. And interestingly, one of the tunes on this album is New Nuke, which I think is just hilarious. It doesn't sound much like Coltrane. That is the track, though, that is closer to Bob. It's kind of a more traditional quartet.
Is it Nuke Sonny Rollins' nickname?
Yeah, absolutely right. It's his nickname. It doesn't sound a lot like Rollins, but yeah, there's one that recording there. Most of the other horns drop away, and you hear Simmons playing in a little bit more traditional idiom. So yeah, one to track down if you can and listen to it. It's a good one.
Of all the things you wished you'd never done, I've heard you say that this is number one. Another life down another road, perhaps you're better off to never know. Don't dream of all the ways things could have.
Well, do you got any pop matters to discuss?
I have no pop matters.
Okay. Yeah, so a couple things. Older stuff, I for some reason thought I had a copy of the Fix's album Reach the Beach, but didn't. So I got one of those, and it just takes me back to my youth. There's some very good singles on that album, and it's extremely uptight funk and very of its time, but enjoyable. I got a fancy LP version of Sunflower by the Beach Boys. I haven't talked about this before, have I?
Sunflower. Have you ever talked about the voice before? Just every other podcast.
This particular issue of it.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just barely. Yeah.
Hello. You're cool. Hello.
Anyway, so a fancy LP version of this. Yeah, I don't know that I love that group. I don't know that their recordings stand up that well to being really beautifully and thoroughly and accurately reproduced. It's the nature of the studio beast. You can kind of hear the seams a bit too well, but it's a really fun late period Beach Boys recording, by which I mean early 70s, in terms of their actual artistic production. And it's definitely worth hearing if you like their music at all. But Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to get any more of these real fancy LP versions. I think they're just a little bit merciless in terms of letting you hear all the patches that were needed to put that sound together. And then more recently, I listened to more recent music, Mac DeMarco's. Have you ever heard of Mac DeMarco?
I have.
You're ahead of me, man. He's apparently kind of a well-known indie figure, and at once he put a drumstick up his butt or something. He's some kind of weird comedian, wacky guy. Anyway, the album is This Old Dog.
That seems avant-garde.
Yeah, and Mac DeMarco is, this album is the only one I've heard. I don't necessarily want to look up other ones. I like it fairly well. I just bought it on the, downloaded it on the strength of listening to a couple tracks and liking the sound. Very laid back. He sings like the guy from The Clientele. I didn't know that anyone else did that.
Oh, wow.
If you've ever heard The Clientele, that kind of very mellow sound where it sounds a bit whimsical and every phrase kind of drops off at the end. He sings just like that. And his groove, someone compared them, I think, quite correctly to J.J. Cale. Also a little bit reminds me a bit of Kurt Vile. But the difference is he gets these kind of mellow, syncopated sounding grooves going along, percolating, and the harmonies are very cyclical, and it's a kind of sound that you think, this could go on for 15 minutes, right? It's Kurt Vile will do this, so kind of get this neat groove going and kind of write it. And this album will get one going, and it just stops after 2.5 minutes or three. Most of the songs are quite short, but they aren't quite put together the way you think of a 2.5 minute Beach Boys song or Beatles song. They're set up like a J.J. Cale song or a Kurt Vile song where they're effective, but the whole point seems to be kind of establishing this percolating mood and then just going with it indefinitely. But he doesn't. He stops it. The lyrics are fairly personal. A lot of stuff, apparently he never got along with his father and it's bothered him his whole life, and he talks about that, I think, pretty effectively. They're very laconic. They're not ornate in any way. But yeah, it's quite arguably dad rock. It's certainly laid back. It seems pretty mercilessly clear-eyed in terms of the lyrics. I mean, they're mellow lyrics, but they aren't just kind of empty-headed. They're kind of directly addressing emotional shit and kind of doing it in a matter-of-fact and a clear-eyed way. So I like the record a lot, but it's a strange mix of influences, and it's not set up. As I said, the songwriting, it works. It's effective. He knows what he's doing, but it's just oddly truncated in most cases with these kind of grooves that I think of as being able to kind of go on and on and on. Towards the end of the record, he does stretch out Moonlight on the River for 7 minutes. And you get the feeling every single one of these could have been stretched out in that same way, and it would have been very effective. He just doesn't. And that concludes episode 119 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com or on our Facebook page. Our next episode will actually address some of your suggestions, and we're hoping to incorporate more as time goes by. But we're always eager for more ideas for the podcast, so please don't hesitate to send those to us. As always, the podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com and from iTunes. Tune in next time as we discuss work by Betty Levette, Frank Zappa, Ed Palermo's Big Band, and Joni Mitchell. Until next time, take care.